Chapter 6. Are you, old fellow, when did you get in? And the young pilots who used to tell me, patronizingly, that I could never learn the river cannot keep from showing a little of their chagrin at seeing me so far ahead of them. Permit me to blow my horn, for I derive a living pleasure from these things, and I must confess that, when I go to pay my dues, I rather like to let the D-D rascals get a glimpse of a $100 bill peeping out from amongst notes of smaller dimensions, whose face I do not exhibit. You will despise this egotism, but I tell you there is a term joy in it. Pilots did not remain long on one boat, as a rule. Just why it is not so easy to understand. Perhaps they liked the experience of change. Perhaps both captain and pilot liked the pursuit of the ideal. In the light-hearted letter that follows, written to a friend of the family, formerly of Hannibal, we get something of the uncertainty of the pilot's engagements. To Mrs. Elizabeth W. Smith, in Jackson, Cape Girardeau County, Mo. Street Louis, October 31, probably 1859. Dear Aunt Betsy, Ma has not written you, because she did not know when I would get started down the river again. You see, Aunt Betsy, I made but one trip on the packet after you left, and then concluded to remain at home a while. I have just discovered this morning that I am to go to New Orleans on the Al. Chambers, fine, light draft, swift running passenger steamer, all modern accommodations and improvements, through with dispatch for freighter passage, apply on board, or two, but I have forgotten the agent's name, however, it makes no difference, and as I was saying, or had intended to say, Aunt Betsy, probably, if you are ready to come up, you had better take the N. Lewis, the best boat in the packet line. She will be at Cape Girardeau at noon on Saturday, day after tomorrow, and will reach here at breakfast time, Sunday. If Mr. Hamilton is chief clerk, very well, I am slightly acquainted with him. And if Messrs. Carter Gray and Dean somebody, I have forgotten his other name, are in the pilot house, very well, again I am acquainted with them. Just tell Mr. Gray and Betsy that I wish him to place himself at your command. All the family are well except myself. I am in a bad way again. Disease, love, in its most malignant form. Hopes are entertained of my recovery, however. At the dinner table, excellent symptom, I am still as arable as an army with banners. Aunt Betsy, the wickedness of this world, but I haven't time to moralize this morning. Goodbye, Sam Clemens. As we do not hear of this tack again, the recovery was probably prompt. His letters are not frequent enough for us to keep track of his boats, but we know that he was associated with Bixby from time to time, and now and again with one of the Bowen boys, his old Hannibal schoolmates. He was reveling in the river life, the ease and distinction and romance of it. No other life would ever suit him as well. He was at the age to enjoy just what it brought him at the airy, golden, overweening age of youth. To Orion Clemens, in Keokuk, Iowa. St. Louis, MCH. 1860. My dear bro. Your last has just come to hand. It reminds me strongly of Tom Hood's letters to his family, which I have been reading lately, but yours only remind me of his, for although there is a striking likeness, your humor is much finer than his, and far better expressed. Tom Hood's wit, in his letters, has a savor of labor about it which is very disagreeable. Your letter is good. That portion of it wherein the old soul figures is the very best thing I have seen lately. Its quiet style resembles Goldsmith's Itizen of the World, and On Quixote, which are my beau ideals of fine writing. You have paid the preacher. Well, that is good, also. What a man wants with religion in these breadless times surpasses my comprehension. Pamela and I have just returned from a visit to the most wonderfully beautiful painting which this city has ever seen, Church's Yurt of the Andes, which represents a lovely valley with its rich vegetation in all the bloom, and glory of a tropical summer dotted with birds and flowers of all colors and shades of color, and sunny slopes, and shady corners, and twilight groves, and cool cascades all grandly set off with a majestic mountain in the background with its gleaming summit clothed in everlasting ice and snow. I have seen it several times, but it is always a new picture, totally new. You seem to see nothing the second time which you saw the first. We took the opera glass, and examined its beauties minutely, for the naked eye cannot discern the little wayside flowers, and soft shadows and patches of sunshine, and half-hidden bunches of grass, and jets of water which form some of its most enchanting features. There is no slurring of perspective effect about it. The most distant, the minutest object in it has a marked and distinct personality, so that you may count the very leaves on the trees. When you first see the tame, ordinary-looking picture, your first impulse is to turn your back upon it, and say umbug, but your third visit will find your brain gasping and straining with futile efforts to take all the wonder in and appreciate it in its fullness, and understand how such a miracle could have been conceived, and executed by human brain and human hands. You will never get tired of looking at the picture, but your reflections, your efforts, to grasp an intelligible something you hardly know what will grow, so painful that you will have to go away from the thing, in order to obtain relief. You may find relief, but you cannot banish the picture, it remains with you still. It is in my mind now, and the smallest feature could not be removed without my detecting it. So much for the ear of the Andes. Ma was delighted with her trip, but she was disgusted with the girls for allowing me to embrace and kiss them, and she was horrified at the schottische as performed by Miss Castle and myself. She was perfectly willing for me to dance until 12 o'clock at the imminent peril of my going, to sleep on the after watch, but then she would top off with a very inconsistent sermon on dancing in general, ending with a terrific broadside aimed at that heresy of heresies, the schottische. I took Ma and the girls in a carriage, round that portion of New Orleans, where the finest gardens and residences are to be seen, and although it was a blazing hot moldy day, they seemed hugely delighted. To use an expression which is commonly ignored in polite society, they were bent on stealing some of the luscious looking oranges from branches which overhung the fences, but I restrained them. They were not aware before that shrubbery could be made to take any queer shape which a skillful gardener might choose to twist it into, so they found, not only beauty, but novelty in their visit. We went out to Lake Pontchartrain in the cars. Your brother Sam Clemens, we have not before heard of Miss Castle, who appears to have been one of the girls who accompanied Jane Clemens on the trip which her son gave her to New Orleans, but we may guess that the other was his cousin and good comrade, Ella Creel. One wishes that he might have left us a more extended account of that long-ago river journey, a fuller glimpse of a golden age that has vanished as completely as the days of Washington. We may smile at the natural youthful desire to air his reading, and his art appreciation, and we may find his opinions not without interest. We may even commend them in part. Perhaps we no longer count the leaves on church's trees, but goldsmith and servants still deserve the place assigned them. He does not tell us what boat he was on at this time, but later in the year he was with Bixby again, on the Alonzo Child. We get a bit of the pilot in port in his next. To Orion Clemens, in Keokuk, Iowa. Lonzo Child, N. Orleans, September 28, 1860. Dear brother, I just received yours and Molly's letter yesterday. They had been here 2 weeks, forwarded from St. Louis. We got here yesterday, we'll leave at noon today. Of course I have had no time, in 24 hours, to do anything. Therefore I'll answer, after we are underway again. Yesterday, I had many things to do, but Bixby and I got with the pilots of 2 other boats, and went off dissipating on a $10 dinner at a French restaurant, breathed not unto Ma, where we ate sheep head, fish with mushrooms, shrimps, and oysters, birds, coffee with brandy burned in it, and 8, drank and smoked, from 2 p.m. until 5 o'clock, and then the day was too far gone to do anything. Please find enclosed, and acknowledge receipt of $20. 000 in haste Sam 50. Clemens, it should be said, perhaps, that when he became pilot Jane Clemens had released her son from his pledge in the matter of cards and liquor. This license did not upset him, however. He cared very little for either of these dissipations. His one great indulgence was tobacco, a matter upon which he was presently to receive some grave counsel. He reports it in his next letter, a sufficiently interesting document. The clairvoyant of this visit was Madame Caprell, famous in her day. Clemens had been urged to consult her, and one idle afternoon concluded to make the experiment. The letter reporting the matter to his brother is fragmentary, and is the last remaining to us of the piloting period. Fragment of a letter to Orion Clemens, in Keokuk, Iowa. New Orleans, February 6, 1862. She's a very pleasant little lady, rather pretty, about 28, say 5 feet 2 and 1 quarter, would weigh 116, has black eyes and hair, is polite and intelligent, used good language, and talks much faster than I do. She invited me into the little back parlor, closed the door, and we were alone. We sat down facing each other. Then she asked my age. Then she put her hands before her eyes a moment, and commenced talking, as if she had a good deal to say, and not much time to say it in. Something after this style. Madam, yours is a watery planet. You gain your livelihood on the water, but you should have been a lawyer. There is where your talents lie. You might have distinguished yourself as an orator, or as an editor. You have written a great deal. You write well, but you are rather out of practice. No matter, you will be in practice someday. You have a superb constitution, and as excellent health as any man in the world. You have great powers of endurance. In your profession, your strength holds out against the longest sieges, without flagging. Still, the upper part of your lungs, the top of them is slightly affected. You must take care of yourself. You do not drink, but you use entirely too much tobacco, and you must stop it. Mind, not moderate, but stop the use of it totally. Then I can almost promise you 86, when you will surely die. Otherwise look out for 28, 31, 34, 47, and 65. Be careful, for you are not of a long-lived race, that is on your father's side. You are the only healthy member of your family, and the only one in it who has anything like the certainty of attaining to a great age, so stop using tobacco, and be careful of yourself. In some respects you take after your father, but you are much more like your mother, who belongs to the long-lived energetic side of the house. You never brought all your energies to bear upon any subject, but what you accomplished it, for instance, you are self-made. Self-educated. S. 50. 100. Which proves nothing. Madam. Don't interrupt. When you sought your present occupation, you found 1,000 obstacles in the way, obstacles unknown, not even suspected by any, save you and me, since you keep such matters to yourself, but you fought your way, and hit the long struggle under a mask of cheerfulness, which saved your friend's anxiety on your account. To do all this requires all the qualities I have named. S. 50. 100. You flatter well, madam. Madam. Don't interrupt. Up to within a short time you had always lived from hand to mouth. Now you are in easy circumstances, for which you need give credit to no one but yourself. The turning point in your life occurred in 1840-7-8. S. 50. 100. Which was, madam, a death perhaps, and this threw you upon the world, and made you what you are. It was always intended that you should make yourself. Therefore, it was well that this calamity occurred as early as it did. You will never die of water, although your career upon it in the future seems well sprinkled with misfortune. You will continue upon the water for some time yet. You will not retire finally until 10 years from now. What is your brother's age? 35, and a lawyer? And in pursuit of an office? Well, he stands a better chance than the other two, and he may get it. He is too visionary, is always flying off on a new hobby. This will never do, tell him I said so. He is a good lawyer, a very good lawyer, and a fine speaker, is very popular and much respected, and makes many friends. But although he retains their friendship, he loses their confidence by displaying his instability of character. The land he has now will be very valuable after a while, S50. 100. Say a 50 years hence, or thereabouts. Madam. No less time, but never mind the land, that is a secondary consideration. Let him drop that for the present, and devote himself to his business and politics with all his might, for he must hold offices under the government. After a while you will possess a good deal of property, retire at the end of 10 years, after which your pursuits will be literary, try the law, you will certainly succeed. I am done now. If you have any questions, to ask them freely, and if it be in my power, I will answer without reserve. I asked a few questions of minor importance, paid her $2, and left, under the decided impression that going to the fortune teller's was just as good as going to the opera, and the cost scarcely a trifle more. Ergo, I will disguise myself and go again, one of these days, when other amusements fail. Now isn't she the devil? That is to say, isn't she a right smart little woman? When you want money, let Ma know, and she will send it. She and Pamela are always fussing about change, so I sent them 120 quarters yesterday. Fiddler's change enough to last till I get back, I reckon. Sam. It is not so difficult to credit Madame Caprell with clairvoyant powers when one has read the letters of Samuel Clemens up to this point. If we may judge by those that have survived, her prophecy of literary distinction for him was hardly warranted by anything she could have known of his past performance. These letters of his youth have a value today only because they were written by the man who later was to become Mark Twain. The squibs and skits which he sometimes contributed to the New Orleans papers were bright, perhaps, and pleasing to his pilot associates, but they were without literary value. He was 25 years old. More than one author has achieved reputation at that age. Mark Twain was of slower growth. At that age he had not even developed a definite literary ambition. Whatever the basis of Madame Caprell's prophecy, we must admit that she was a good guesser on several matters, a right smart little woman, as Clemens himself phrased it. She overlooked one item, however. The proximity of the Civil War. Perhaps it was too close at hand for second sight. A little more than 2 months after the Caprell letter was written, Fort Sumter was fired upon. Mask Twain had made his last trip as a pilot up the river to St. Louis. The nation was plunged into a 4 years conflict. There are no letters of this immediate period. Young Clemens went. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.